You're listening to the DistressedPro.com Professionals Podcast Series, where you hear from experts in the distressed real estate arena and where our goal is to educate and inform you so that you can grow your business. This is one of three episodes with John McCaffrey, a former Wall Street banker who currently works with top-tier banks selling non-performing or criticized assets and REO with Auction.com. In this episode, we talk about FDIC loss sharing, what it is, how it impacts a bank's ability to sell, and some tips on how to work with banks to sell assets under loss share agreements. So the other thing that I want, and I know we've been running really long, and if you have to go, I'll let you.
Oh, no, it's fine. Go right ahead.
Okay. So the other thing that I want to talk with you about, and for a couple of reasons, is the loss sharing. And I know there's a lot of misunderstanding out there about how it works and what it does and who benefits and this sort of a thing. And we're about to, the FDIC now has made, there's some changes. And so if you are, if you're a bank and you're in a loss sharing agreement, you now have some pretty extensive reporting that you have to do, in terms of what, you know, assets you have that are covered under this agreement. And so, what, if you could just lay down a little bit for me, or for us, how you see the loss sharing agreements impacting asset sales, that would be great.
Yeah, no, that's another wonderful question. I'll give you just a quick brief history of loss sharing arrangements. The original crisis that many of us probably remember was the early 1990s, and you know that was affectionately known as the savings and loan crisis. And I myself worked for a savings and loan back then. And, you know, they created a company called the RTC. It was the Resolution Trust Corporation. And, you know, they sold a lot of assets outside of banks. The loss share arrangements were created as a tool that the FDIC used to really entice healthy banks to acquire not only the deposits of failing banks, but to also have the failing bank's loan portfolio as well. So, you know, if you're going to take the deposits, then I want you know, Mr. Acquiring Bank, to take these, you know, bad assets as well. And, you know, as you can imagine, the acquiring banks, you know, they love the deposits, but they don't want the messy assets. And so the FDIC really had to, you know, create something to entice them. Essentially, what we run into now is the FDIC enters into a loss sharing agreement in connection with, you know, any agreements that the healthy bank has to essentially acquire all the deposits and most, if not all, of the assets of the failing bank. So, you know, the FDIC gets what they want through using this agreement. Mm-hmm. The specifics are essentially that they actually have two loss-sharing agreements that they enter into. The acquiring bank will enter into an agreement that essentially says that they will purchase it is the single family loan portfolio. So that's agreement number one. They make that a separate agreement. The second agreement applies to everything but the single family portfolio.
Okay.
So there are two agreements. The particulars are essentially that the acquiring bank will retain 20% of the loan losses that are incurred in connection with the acquired loan portfolio up to an agreed maximum amount, okay, of aggregate losses. There are, you know, every agreement is a little different in the sense that everybody has a different maximum that they reach.
Okay.
Ultimately, the FDIC then will assume up to 95% of the acquiring bank's 95% of the losses, and the acquiring bank will retain only 5% of the losses. After they reach that maximum, so the percentages change. They also they also get reimbursed if there are any fees associated with the servicing of that loan and you know, what have you. So they do get reimbursed for that.
Fully?
It is fully, absolutely, yeah, it is. And then kind of the flip side to that is that, if there are any recoveries, the FDIC gets to share in those. So, it's really a kind of a two-way agreement. If there's any upside, then, money flows back into the FDIC. And if there is any losses, then, money flows out of the FDIC. And, that's how the agreements work. The term on these things is typically 8 years for non-single-family portfolios. As again, I said there's two different agreements, and then 10 years for the single-family portfolio.
Okay.
Now, what impacts our industry is the idea of a bank having lots of assets from a failed acquired bank, assets that our industry would love to help dispose of.
Sure.
These can be in the form of notes. They can be in the form of REO. And, what you run up against is bank sellers, essentially saying that, we're under a loss share agreement. And so, what does that mean? Well, the particulars are that the FDIC says that you cannot sell an asset for less than market value, mm-hmm. is what it says.
Which is
whether it's a note or a piece of property,
right.
Real estate.
Right.
And so therein lies the problem, the quandrum that we're in the sense is how does anybody determine what fair market value is?
Right.
Now, FDIC says that, you have to get a professional valuer.
Yep.
In these cases, they can be, either appraisers and or, real estate professionals that sell assets in a particular marketplace.
So you could get a BPO and
absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah. BPO.
Yeah.
And so, in liquid markets, and by the way, we are in an illiquid market. Many of you probably know that. But in liquid markets, those methods of valuation work just fine. And the reason that they work just fine is because there is plenty of recent historical data. And when I say recent, I'm talking within the last 6 months.
Right.
Historical data of recent sales, and so you can compare values around the country for particular assets, and it makes it a fairly easy thing to do. But in illiquid markets, the appraisal and the broker's opinion of values, the tools that a particular bank would use to meet the standards of their loss agreement with FDIC, they unfortunately don't work that well because, because of what we just said, there are not a lot of comparables out there to determine where things are ultimately valued. And, as far as income-producing properties go, you also run into a situation where, in a perfect world, this would be a great asset. But, in a down economy, the numbers just don't work necessarily.
Sure.
So is it a question that, the neighborhood is bad or the asset is bad or the economy is bad? Is the owner just have too much, not enough money, and so you run into a lot of different variables there. Now, from the business of being in the auction business, we have kind of a funny take on this, and that is that you can essentially say that something is worth a particular amount all day long. But unless, you know, the old adage is, unless you have somebody willing to pay you that number,
right,
you know, it's just a number.
Right.
And you know, why we kind of laugh in the auction business is that, you know, auctions work very well in illiquid markets. And I'll just briefly, you know, expand upon that statement. Buyers, regardless of what they want to buy and where they want to buy it and how they want to buy it, they look at cycles like this as being an opportunity cycle. Mm-hmm. In other words, there's no buyer out there that wants to pay retail for anything. You know, this is a buyer's market. Why do I need to pay retail? And that attitude really affects the retail sale that, again, brokers' opinions are based off of and appraisals are based off of.
Right.
You know, true retail sales. And people say, well, you know, I don't want to pay true retail because, you know, this is a depressed market and I'm, you know, it's buyer's market and by golly, I'm going to get a deal somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
So the auction works very well. The word auction works very well because it is really kind of the sign that says, hey, you know, buyer populace, this is where your deal is.
Mm-hmm.
It's not out there somewhere. It's all right here. And so auction houses from across the country, you know, they do provide a wonderful service for illiquid markets. Now, the, you know, kind of the smile that we have on our faces is in the auction business is one that says, you know, we are really the only ones that truly know what the market is, because, you know, we are the ones that are enabling the most highest percentage of transactions.
Sure.
And, you know, as opposed to retail out there, it's really the auctions that are making the transactions happen in the country right now.
Right.
And so, if you wanted to know where the market is, well, then ask the thousands and thousands of people that go to auctions and buy real estate. Not so much the, you know, the retail market out there. So, you know, to kind of end, you know, this ramble that I'm doing here is that you have a scenario where banks have these assets. They're under a loss share agreement. They should and could and would like to sell, but because FDIC is saying, well, you cannot sell these unless you get a fair market value. And, you know, well, what is the fair market value? Well, it's something that an appraiser writes down, you know, based on liquid markets. And you're just never going to accomplish that. I mean,
right.
You know, never say never, but for the most part, you can't accomplish that. And so the banks are fairly frustrated themselves as well. You know, many banks have decided that, you know, if assets are wrapped in a loss share agreement, then they just have to shelve those because there's no way they can meet the standard, which is, you know, you got to get the appraised value or some sort of, you know, a broker's opinion.
Right.
You know, and a lot of sellers equate the auction process, or at least the word auction, with fire sale. Well, it just really couldn't be farther from the truth, you know, because when you have, you know, you bring people together in a competitive marketplace, it, you know, competition always raises prices. You know, everybody learned that in high school economics.
Right.
And so what you end up having here is, you know, is some banks that have basically said, well, the we understand that the world that we're living in within this loss share agreement is probably not realistic, and that we will, you know, attempt to prove to FDIC that we have done everything that we said we would as far as trying to get a market value for something. And you know, how we help sellers on our end is that we provide them with a lot of reporting that allows them to go back and show FDIC that, you know, look, on this particular day we had, you know, over 1,000 eyeballs look at a particular asset, and then that yielded X amount of participants, and then we came up with a winner. And we, you know, and essentially, if you show enough, if you're able to prove that you have enough eyes on a particular asset, and that the process was an open, transparent process, then it seems to work. We do have many clients, some of them quite large, that have decided that the auction process in general is one that fits within the guidelines, and that the reporting that we provide to them is enough for FDIC to say, okay, well, you've done an okay job, and, you know, this is all right. It is on a case-per-case basis. You know, it is on a bank-per-bank basis. You know, perhaps the situation is that some banks are treated better than other banks. I don't want to say that with certainty, and I hope that that's not the case, but sometimes we do see that that might be the case. And so the flip side to that is that there are obviously some banks that, for whatever reason, maybe they're not as friendly with the FDIC, that they just really do not want to, use any other means than a listing agent and, selling things through a traditional process.
Right. Right, through a listing agent and some waiting, I guess, generally.
Well, it's a great joke, isn't it? You know, here's your listing agent, and oh, by the way, do you have 12 to 24 months?
Right, sure.
You know, it's
and nothing against listing agents in any way. Of course, there's, you know, two auctioneers on the phone. We've got, you know, our own opinions, but law sharing then. Good for the bank. They take on all this new deposit. Good for the bank. They're really not going to lose too much on the assets that they're really acquiring pretty rapidly, and probably don't. You know, it's not that like they have the time to go through and identify, you know, individually, you know, risk and whatnot.
Right.
About that. And bad though, because it's really going to sort of slow down their disposition process. Bad for them, bad for all of us in the business. But it sounds like the cure to that slowdown, what I'm hearing from you is really, if you can provide enough evidence or documentation that what you're achieving really is market, then you're going to be okay, and you're going to be able to move that stuff along.
Absolutely. And you do that with reporting, and hopefully your process allows a lot of, you know, draws in a lot of buyers, potential buyers, and eyeballs to look at the asset.
Right.
And that offsets the, another thing that we have working in our favor in this particular case is time. I am seeing the overall sentiment in the banking community, change for the better. In other words, their mindset was, well, we only want to use a traditional method because that's what we've always done. You know, I don't knock anybody for wanting to do what they know how to do. We have workout people in place. We have REO group in place. We have relationships with, realtors, in our footprint.
Yeah.
And that's the way they want to do business, and I respect that. But that mindset changes dramatically and quickly as time continues to tick. If you cannot work out alone and you don't want to recapture the property, then it kind of sits in limbo. And eventually, the FDIC, wants you to do something with that loan. You know, either work it out or turn it into REO.
Right.
And so, time is is a factor there. On the REO side, you know, as we've said many times before, you know, once you own that property, once you've recaptured it, then you know you got to be prepared to write some checks.
Right.
Now there are instances that, you know, some income-producing properties, you know, do yield a little bit of money, and they're okay for the bank. But you know, for the most part, more money goes out the door than comes in. And so as you as they live through this illiquid market and they start to realize, well, wait a second, you know, in the past, you know, things didn't sit on the market for more than 90 days. And, you know, maybe if the world was, you know, not that great, maybe it would be for 6 months. Well, a lot of banks are seeing things for, you know, 12 months and longer.
Right.
And so that time factor really influences and is changing, you know, the mindset of the bank sellers at this point.
And so we've been on the phone for a while, and I really appreciate you giving us all this time. You just said one thing there, though, that I have to ask about before I let you go. And what you just said that is that you can have a thing in non-accrual or 90 plus in for a while, but at some point the FDIC is going to want to see you do something with that. And do you have a sense of what that time frame looks like, or how they determine what you know when you need to move on something as a bank?
Well, I've the simple and direct answer is that no, I don't, and the reason that I don't is because it's different for everyone.
Mm-hmm.
Every single bank, and you know, and this is where I kind of do a little tongue in cheek that you sometimes, you know, after meeting with many banks, hearing each of their stories, you get the feeling that sometimes FDIC is friendlier with some banks and, you know, than others.
Right.
I don't think it's a personal thing. What I do believe is that it is just a numbers thing. You know, some banks are healthier than others, and so the, you know, to have, you know, for lack of a better word, the wrath of Sheila Bair, you know, come down on you. Sheila Bair being the head of the FDIC,
yep.
You know, I think that it's really a numbers generated thing, you know, and all banks, you know, strong and weak at this point, have been given orders of some sort or another, some worse than others, some better than others,
mm-hmm.
but everybody's been given orders to clean it up.
Situation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Based on their own number situation, and the orders are very simple, you know, get it cleaned up. And you know, if a bank has a problem with particular, you know, capital issues, then, you know, hopefully they're given enough time to raise some capital, but, you know, in order to make these moves from non-accrual over into the REO side and what have you. But, yeah, the bottom line here is that there is absolute pressure that is put on by FDIC, some more than others, but it is always there, absolutely.
Cool. Well, this has been just super informative for me, and I'm sure it has been for a lot of the folks who are listening, and I really appreciate you taking the time. And if people want to find you, they can find you on LinkedIn.
I'm on LinkedIn, and my direct email address, is it okay to give an email address?
Absolutely.
Here?
Yep.
Okay. It's John MC, that's JohnMC, at auction.com.
Okay.
I'd be
awesome.
Happy to.
Happy to chat with anybody who reaches out.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, thanks, John. That was a marathon. I'll probably divide this into a few pieces just so people can take it all in. But I really, really appreciate it.
No, pleasure's all mine. Thank you.
If you found this podcast helpful, we'd love it if you'd rate us in iTunes or subscribe there. You can find all of our podcasts at distressedpro.com as well as Bank Prospector, which is the online software that allows you to find and banks with distressed assets, non-performing loans, and REO, as well as bank contacts.